I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. It looks like the deep freeze that began with the start of 2018 is slowly losing its grip on the East Coast and parts of the Midwest. Not only did temperatures plunge into the single digits and below, it was windy. The wind chill at the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire made it feel like 100 degrees below zero this weekend. President Trump tweeted about the cold and questioned the existence of global warming, but as scientists keep saying over and over, there is a difference between weather and climate. Today on Radio Times, we want to talk about this cold snap and last year's extreme weather events, including hurricanes and droughts and fires, and what it says about our changing environment. Joining us is Jennifer Francis. She is research professor at Rutgers University's Department of Marine and Coastal Science, and she has spent much of her career studying the Arctic. Jennifer Francis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us is Michael Mann, joining us from the studios of Penn State University. He is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State, also Director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, and he's got a new book for children out on climate change called The Tantrum That Saved the World. Michael Mann, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Let me quote something the president said right before New Year's Eve. He said in the East, and this is, of course, was a tweet, it could be the coldest New Year's Eve on record. Perhaps we could use a little bit of good old global warming that our country, but not other countries, was going to pay trillions of dollars to protect against. Bundle up. This is a very basic question for you, Michael Mann. What's the difference between weather and climate? What does the president, and I have to say a lot of other people, do not understand?
Yeah, well, there are various analogies that we use to distinguish between weather, which is the day-to-day fluctuations in, you know, our weather, our temperature, rainfall, snowfall, the vagaries of weather, and climate, which is the longer-term statistics. One saying that's attributed to Mark Twain is that climate is what you expect and weather is what you get. An analogy that I also sometimes like to use is that climate tells you what clothes to buy. Weather tells you what clothes to wear on a given day. So it is important to recognize that there are always going to be fluctuations, weather fluctuations, unusually warm conditions on some days, unusually cold conditions on other days. Think of these as the random rolls of the dice. But what climate is doing is loading those dice towards more extreme weather events of various sorts, which I'm sure we'll get into in more detail here today.
Absolutely. Jennifer Francis, let me get you in on the conversation. Help us understand, though, this bitter cold that we've had since the start of 2018. We've been experiencing something called Winter Storm Grayson. There's the bomb cyclone. What do you think has been driving this particular cold snap?
Well, that's a long answer, actually. But basically, you know, the cold snap that we've been dealing with, it's actually, I would call it a cold spell. It's actually been going on since the middle of December. So the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at below normal temperatures over, say, the eastern two-thirds of North America. And people need to realize that if you look at the bigger picture and look at the whole northern hemisphere, even the globe as a whole, the eastern part of North America really stands out like a sore thumb in the fact that it's basically the only place on the planet that has been experiencing this cold, whereas the rest of the world, for the most part, has been experiencing above normal temperatures. So that tweet that you mentioned from President Trump is, you know, quite myopic in that it's really just talking about one area of the globe. And, you know, the rest of the world really has been experiencing something quite different.
I'm sure there's a long answer to this as well, but let me put it to you, Jennifer Francis, about the warming of the Arctic. Does that drive a lot of our weather?
Well, you know, the Arctic is warming at least twice as fast as anywhere else on the planet, except for maybe just the peninsula of Antarctica. So, you know, this large area of our planet, the Arctic on top of the globe, has a lot to do with weather patterns around the northern hemisphere where billions of people live. And what we're seeing is that because the Arctic is warming so fast, it's having an impact on the jet stream. The jet stream being this very fast-moving river of air high over our heads, up where the jets fly. That's where it gets its name. And the jet stream really does control the weather that we experience in the Northern Hemisphere for the most part. Now, the effect that the rapidly warming Arctic has on the jet stream, this is actually a very new and hot topic of research that's emerged really just in the last 5 years or so, is that we think that it's still a very active area of research, but as I think Michael will say, because he's been involved in this research as well, is that we're seeing a tendency for this jet stream, which normally travels in a relatively straight west-to-east path around the Northern Hemisphere, instead to take much bigger swings north and south. And the reason those big swings are important is because when that happens, as it has been the case for the last 3 weeks or so, when we get these big southern dips, for example, it allows the cold air from the Arctic to plunge much farther south, say down into Florida, where it's been very cold lately. But the opposite also happens. So we also get these big northward swings, and that has been responsible in large part for the dry winter that's been occurring in California, not just this winter, but four of the past five winters has been extremely dry in California. So whatever's happening with the jet stream has a big impact on our weather patterns down here where we all live.
And, of course, Michael Mann, that raises a question whether this is something permanent as a result of climate change or whether we're seeing a kind of a blip or anomaly when it comes to the jet stream and, of course, its effect on our weather.
Yeah, and again, you know, the analogy to draw upon here is that, you know, we're still going to have the vagaries of weather, the randomness of weather from day to day. What climate change seems to be doing is favoring certain types of weather patterns so that they become more common and more persistent. Jennifer mentioned that if you look at the cold spell in the U.S., it's really isolated. The rest of the globe is actually at near record temperatures. So that provides one context for understanding sort of how we cannot generalize from, you know, a cold spell in the eastern U.S. to something like climate change. But it's also important to look over time, not just in space, but if we look back in time, over the last year in the United States, we've broken all-time records for warmth. More than 60 times, more than 60 locations have had the hottest temperature they've ever recorded in the U.S. over the last year. Less than 10 have recorded all-time lows. So that's 6 to 1 all-time highs relative to all-time lows. We are seeing very clearly, when you look at the statistics, the loading of the dice towards warmer events, warmer temperatures. But there is this interesting question, you know, this relative handful of cold extremes, the conditions that favored them, as Jennifer nicely described it. And of course, she's done quite a bit of work in looking at how the decrease in sea ice in the Arctic may be changing the jet stream in a way that favors this pattern that we're seeing right now. It's sometimes called a dipole because, as Jennifer explained, you've got sort of warm air from the south coming up in the west and giving them warm, dry conditions because there's a ridge of high pressure. You don't get rainfall. And then that meander, that upward meander, comes crashing back down from the north in a downward meander in the eastern United States that gives us those very unusually cold conditions associated with the outbreak of Arctic air. And there is indeed a body of research that suggests that climate change may be loading the weather dice towards more frequent occurrence of this very dipole pattern that's giving us the dry, warm west right now and the very cold eastern U.S.
And Jennifer, do we know how long this pattern will take before we can say, aha, this is as a result of climate change, the warming of the Arctic, for instance?
Well, we have a couple of ways of trying to get at that question. One is to look at the real world and how patterns have changed over time actually in the measurements that we can look at of the real world, as I said. But we can also use computer simulations, these very complicated computer models that we can use to look at the climate system and weather patterns, and you'll look at what happens when we continue to increase carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, what happens as the globe continues to warm, what happens as sea ice continues to disappear in the Arctic. And I should just mention for people who haven't been paying attention to this that, you know, the changes in the Arctic are truly breathtaking. In the last 30 years only, we've seen half of the coverage of sea ice disappear.
Wow.
That's half of it in only 30 years. And if we take into account the thickness of that sea ice as well and look at the volume of it, we've lost three quarters of it in that time period. So the changes in the Arctic are literally just humongous. And so it's, you know, it's hard to imagine that changes of that magnitude would not have an impact on the larger system as a whole. So this is the kind of thing that we're starting to look at. Those computer models that I mentioned are telling us that we're definitely going to see further ice loss, further warming, and we'd expect to see the kinds of pattern shifts that we've been talking about here today becoming even more conspicuous. So we've got, you know, these two tools that we can use to try to understand how fast these changes are going to occur, where they're going to occur, and why. And what we're learning, and Michael, I'm sure, will get into this because he's been focusing more on the summer extremes, we're seeing different pattern shifts in different seasons and in different locations. So it's not a simple story. It's a fascinating story, but it's also a very disturbing story because we're talking about extreme weather that's going to have huge impacts on things like agriculture and water resources and extreme storms like we've seen this year.
Michael Mann, about a minute before we have to take a break, and I do want to get into some of these larger trends, but hearing Jennifer Francis describe what is happening, it's easy to feel like, oh my gosh, we're doomed. It's, you know, we're cooked, or we're going to be underwater.
Well, you know, there are two things going on here, and as Jennifer just explained, when you look at what's happening in the Arctic, by many measures, it's happening faster, and it's happening with a greater magnitude than the models actually predicted. So when you hear people say, oh, well, these climate models, they exaggerate the problem, if anything, the models and those, you know, and the scientists who run them, we have underestimated the rate at which some of these changes are occurring. The loss of Arctic sea ice, of course, that is influencing weather extremes here in the U.S., and so we may be seeing more extreme weather than we would have expected at this point for the same reason. So by some measures, yes, it's even worse than we had predicted, but it is important to recognize that when you look at the projections, when you take the best available science, it tells us that we can still avert the most catastrophic and irreversible changes in climate if we act now.
I do want to pick up on that. That's Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University, Jennifer Francis, Research Professor at Rutgers University's Department of Marine and Coastal Science, talking about climate and weather. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Penn State's Michael Mann and Rutgers University's Jennifer Francis about some of the extreme weather we have been experiencing, certainly here on the East Coast and much of the Midwest. We do want to spend some time talking about last year's weather, the hurricanes, the droughts, and the wildfires, I should add, and where we stand when it comes to global climate change, and of course taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me ask both of you, but I'm just curious about President Obama's policies to reduce climate change, whether it had to do with coal-fired power plants or electric cars and increasing mileage for vehicles and other things that he did to try to mitigate the threat of climate change. Michael Mann, was that effective? Did it make a difference, I guess I should ask?
It absolutely did. It gave us credibility at the table when we negotiated with China and other nations around the world to arrive at an agreement, which ultimately took the form of the Paris summit, that would commit the leading nations of the world, in fact, all the nations of the world, with one exception now, the United States under the Trump administration, to reducing carbon emissions substantially. So it was really the Clean Power Plan, the incentives for renewable energy, all of the progress that was taking place in the United States in moving away from fossil fuel energy towards renewable energy that gave us credibility. And again, that credibility was what allowed us to negotiate with China and the rest of the world to arrive at this monumental agreement. Now, what the Trump administration is doing right now, unfortunately, is not just rolling back that progress, the progress under the Obama administration on climate change, but they are literally dismantling all of the environmental protections that have been put in place over half a century by both Democratic and Republican administrations.
Well, let me go to you, Jennifer Francis, and going back to the Paris Accord. And, of course, President Trump pulled us out of the Paris Accord, although I was reading in preparation for the show that we're still part of it, but mostly on paper. But interestingly, the military, large transnational corporations, a number of states, including California, are preparing for climate change. And in the case of California, saying that we're going to abide by the Paris Accord. And I noticed when it comes to things like sea level rise, that these military and large corporations are preparing for what is already happening, sea level rise.
Yes, that's exactly so. And the reason is because it makes a lot of sense on many levels. The military, for example, the Navy in particular, who have a lot of their facilities based on coasts, are seeing the evidence before their very eyes of sea level rise and realize that their infrastructure is in jeopardy. And so they're taking steps to try to prepare for what they know is coming. And various states, you mentioned California, but Massachusetts is another one, and many others realize that they also have issues related to climate change that they can already measure and witness and realize that they have to do something to get ready for these changes that are coming their way. So, you know, there's a lot of economic reasons as well. You look at a state like Texas that is producing a tremendous amount of wind-powered electricity now, even though, you know, perhaps their government is not, or their state government is not on board with human-caused climate change in general, but they realize that it's an economic advantage now. It's where the jobs are coming from. Solar and wind produced many more jobs over the last several years than any fossil fuel industries. And so the writing is on the wall on many levels that keeping going with the incentives and the programs that the Obama administration started just makes a lot of sense.
Michael Mann, I wonder whether the insurance companies will do what the Trump administration is not willing to do in some of these cases.
Yeah, well, that's the good news, as you've already alluded to. When we look at what's happening with some of the largest companies in the United States that are getting on board, that have said we need to maintain our commitment to the Paris Accord. You've even ExxonMobil, the world's largest fossil fuel company, actually, you know, said that it makes sense for us to stay in the Paris Accord. You're seeing amazing progress at the municipal level, the city level, the state level, groups of states banding together, the West Coast states, the New England states, and now New Jersey, Jennifer's state, where Rutgers is, now joining that Northeastern coalition of states that are going to regulate carbon emissions, put a price on carbon, provide incentives for renewable energy. And so by some estimates, even if we technically pull out of the Paris Accord, if Trump pulls out of the Paris Accord, just based on the progress that's happening at the local level, at the state level, and the progress that's happening within the business community, we will actually meet our obligations under the Paris Accord.
Wow.
Now, Paris
wow.
alone isn't enough. We've got to improve on that. Yep.
But interestingly, well, that raises a whole host of questions, which we won't have time to get into. Let me get a couple of callers in. We've got Terry from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Terry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been studying a lot on these issues with the carbon dioxide and CO2 in the atmosphere, and it seems like when you look at some of these studies, like by Seth Wines and Kimberly Nicholas in their environmental research letters, and they show high impact, solutions. Certainly, eating a plant-based diet, or driving an electric vehicle, or getting green energy, or flying less can certainly be important. But the number one, and it pales in comparative to all other initiatives out there, is to have smaller families and reduce our population as a major impact towards climate change. And Paul Hawken, also in his book, says that the number one issue, too, as far as educating and empowering women and providing family planning, because the population factor is a major issue. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Terry, thanks for the call. Francis, can you, Jennifer Francis, can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, there's no silver bullet to dealing with this problem. We have to try every avenue that we know about. Certainly, reducing population would be a big one. It's also a difficult one in some areas, but, all of the different activities that have been going on, the ones that Michael mentioned, electric cars, recycling, just conserving energy. If each of us could conserve energy, when you save one electron of electricity, you actually save much more than that, because it takes a lot of energy to create that electron that came out of your electric plug in your home. So there are many, many things that we should be doing simultaneously in parallel. All of us need to play a role and do whatever we can. It needs to happen at the top level of government, but it also needs to happen within each of our homes. And I think one of the problems that I've noticed is that even people who are on board with understanding the problem and realizing that it's something we have to deal with, they haven't yet taken it on board onto their own person and changed their own behavior. So this is just something that we all have to get a grip on and do whatever we can on a personal basis, which includes voting for leaders who are on board with making progress on this very important problem.
Terry, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Here's a follow-up email for you, Michael Mann from Sarah. Dr. Mann says we can avert the worst impacts of climate change if we act now. Picking up on what Jennifer Francis just said, what actions would actually be enough or do enough to achieve this?
Yeah, and this sort of pulls in that previous question as well, as Jennifer explained. There is no sort of magic bullet. There are many things we need to be doing. Certainly, personal choices, individual behavior is important. Population, global population, is an issue, but it isn't so much the number of people as how those people are using energy, how much energy they're using, how many resources they're using. And the real threat right now isn't so much global population, which is starting to plateau. The real threat is people in sort of third world countries now starting to live a more industrial-like lifestyle, starting to use far more energy, far more resources. That's really, when it comes to carbon emissions, that's the real threat. If people in China, people in India start using as much energy as we here in the United States use, that's where we start to see the greatest threat in terms of increasing carbon emissions. And so, again, it comes back to countries, Western countries like the United States, who had sort of the primary role in creating this problem in the first place. We need to sort of have our own house in order if we are going to convince the Chinas and the Indias of the world that they too are not entitled to their own fossil fuel industry, fossil fuel funded economic boom. We need to get them to leapfrog past fossil fuels towards the energy of the future, renewable energy. Now, as Jennifer mentioned, a very important part of this, if we are going to solve this problem, personal behavior, voluntary measures alone are not going to be enough. We're going to need government incentives that help lead that transition away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. It's already underway. It's happening, but we need to accelerate that transition if we're going to limit carbon emissions below dangerous levels. How do we accelerate that transition? By putting in place economic incentives for fossil fuels by putting a price on carbon. And the only way that's going to happen is if we have policymakers in office who are willing to represent our interests instead of the special interests that too often fund their campaigns.
Hey, Gregory's calling us from Philadelphia on this very point. Gregory, go ahead. You're on Radio Times, and I'll give Jennifer Francis a chance to respond.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having my call.
Sure.
One thing that I'm really worried about is the local action of utilities and electricity. I know that electricity is such a huge portion of our local emissions, and these companies are just seem to be really committed to the business of climate change. And, you know, we have our local utility, PECO, which just gets tiny proportions of their energy from renewables, and they seem to be waiting for others to get ahead. And I'm really curious about what would happen if they took a much bigger leadership role and moved rapidly. You know, the city is making commitments, but we don't really hear those same commitments backed up by cooperation from the utilities.
Well, you know, I don't think we can speak directly to PECO, but Jennifer Francis, just in terms of, I guess, our reliance or over-reliance on fossil fuels, picking up on what Michael Mann said, can we move in that direction? And often it's put to us, which is you have jobs over here and then you have renewables over there, a feeling as if the two do not coexist.
Right. Well, as Michael mentioned, we're in this transition period from our economy based on fossil fuels for many years now. And of course, we've enjoyed a lot of benefits from that. But now we're realizing that that is not the energy of the future. It's not where we need to go. And so we need to transition to this new energy economy that's not based on fossil fuels. But of course, there are entities like the public utilities, which are still seeing the benefits of inexpensive fossil fuels, and that's where this carbon fee or a carbon basically having to pay for
right.
the carbon that you produced, providing an incentive to get away from fossil fuels, and that's where the you know the upper levels of government come in, where decisions have to be made at high levels to put in place these policies that will provide incentives to get away from fossil fuels and move faster towards renewables.
Michael Mann, do you think a complicated economy like the U.S. could be run on renewable energy?
It's not a matter of what I think. It's you know it we have to look to you know the actual scientific literature and what it has to say. And it is unambiguous. There is a body of work. Mark Jacobson of Stanford is one of the leading researchers in this area, an emerging body of research that demonstrates that we can, in fact, meet 100% non-fossil fuel renewable energy within a matter of a few decades. If you sort of project forward, we could meet our energy demands, our energy needs by mid-century entirely using non-fossil fuels, entirely using renewable energy. We have the technology. We know the economics of it. We just have to scale this technology up. And the way you scale it up is by putting in place incentives, by putting a price on carbon so you level the playing field so renewable energy can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy. And when the playing field is level, we're already seeing that renewable energy can outcompete fossil fuel energy. So we just need to accelerate that transition with the proper market instruments.
Jennifer Francis, even looking ahead to 2018, I mean, certainly in 2017, we had really powerful hurricanes that did a lot of devastation. Of course, the fires and the drought out in California. And this is just talking about the United States, of course, other parts of the world as well. Do you see more of the same for 2018?
Well, it's, you know, in terms of tropical storms, it's always hard to say whether one is actually going to hit land or not. This past year, we were very unlucky in that sense because we had such strong storms that not only formed, but they also took they did a very destructive path as they moved in through the Caribbean and up into the United States. So I'd say, you know, as Michael said in the beginning, the dice are loaded for stronger tropical storms in the future as we warm the oceans. This is just the kind of fuel that tropical storms need. So it's likely that we will see continued strong tropical storms. Whether we see also very damaging fires in the southwest, we'll have to see how the weather pattern unfolds this winter. But again, I think the dice are loaded for this kind of pattern to continue.
Michael Mann, you have a new book for children, The Tantrum That Saved the World. It's really about, what, climate refugees being the animals?
Yeah, I don't want to give away the game.
Well, I don't want to give away too much, but I'm looking at the cover there.
Yeah, it's sort of an empowering story. I worked with a leading children's book writer, Megan Herbert, did the illustrations and the story, and I provided sort of the scientific background. So the first part of the book is this story, and you know the book's aimed at sort of roughly 5 to 10-year-old children. For the older children who want to learn a little bit more, they want to learn the science behind the story, there's a second part of the book that does describe how climate change is indeed impacting many animal species. The tale told by the book is that this girl is encountering these climate refugees. It starts with a polar bear arriving in her room, all of these animals that have been displaced by climate change. And eventually she throws a tantrum, and it's an empowering tantrum. It's a good tantrum. She expresses her frustration with the problem and does something to solve it. So I think it's an empowering book that parents will enjoy reading with their children. It's not a doom and gloom book. It's a book that conveys the appropriate cautious optimism that we have, that we can solve this problem.
We're going to end on that note. Michael Mann, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University, also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, and he's got a new book for kids called The Tantrum That Saved the World. Jennifer Francis, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
And she is research professor at Rutgers University's Department of Marine and Coastal Science, spent much of her career studying the Arctic. We'll be talking about drilling after the short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last Thursday, the Trump administration announced plans to offer gas and oil drilling leases in the waters off of most of the country's coastal states. The proposal would lift the Obama administration's ban and has run into bipartisan headwinds. A number of governors are concerned about the impact on tourism, on fisheries, and the threat of spills. And that includes New Jersey's outgoing Republican Governor Christie and incoming Governor Democrat Murphy. We asked Jennifer Dalohi to join us. She is energy and environment reporter for Bloomberg News. Jennifer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jennifer, what does this proposal say?
Well, essentially, it's the very first step in leasing waters between 2019 and 2024 for drilling. And it basically says that at the most, the government will hold 47 auctions of drilling rights in more than 90% of the U.S. outer continental shelf. So that's waters off the coast of California. It's Atlantic waters. It's in the Arctic. Almost every area was basically left in this plan and left on the table for eventual leasing. It's important to note that this is just the first step. So there will be it will be tailored and probably scaled back in terms of the number of sales and the places that are targeted over the next year before the government gets to a final plan. But it is starting out very big and frankly bigger than we've ever seen before.
I was just going to say unprecedented.
Absolutely. Other administrations have put a lot on the table, but not this much.
So it goes through, what, a comment period, and obviously then Congress. This is an executive order, right?
It's an executive action. It happens completely in the scope of the Interior Department. It's bound by federal laws, and as such, they are going to have to do environmental review of this initial draft program, as well as environmental review of proposed sales later down the line, and they'll take public comment. So there's going to be at least one more proposal coming out middle of the year or so before they get to a final plan, and environmental analysis and public comment all interspersed around that. And frankly, the federal government has to listen to local residents and politicians emissions as one of several factors it must consider in putting together this plan. So the voices of the New Jersey governor and other politicians are going to be pretty influential, I think, in this process.
Let me quote Governor Scott of Florida, Republican, and he said, after this plan was announced, I have asked to immediately meet with Secretary Zinke to discuss the concerns I have with this plan and the crucial need to remove Florida from consideration. My top priority is to ensure that Florida's natural resources are protected. And it seems, as you mentioned, he is not the only governor who is pushing back pretty hard on this plan.
Absolutely not. The West Coast governors of Oregon and Washington State and California are unified in opposition to new leasing off the West Coast, where you do have some ongoing oil production in Southern California dating back, you know, from wells that were drilled decades ago. So they're unified in opposition. You have at least four governors on the East Coast that have said, please leave us out. And that, of course, includes Florida Governor Rick Scott. You know, this is significant. Because the administration is going to hear pushback from Republicans and we'll have to factor that into their final decision.
Help us understand how much water and I guess even ocean governors control versus the federal government.
That's a great question. So in general, states' waters extend about 3 miles from the coastline, and then that's when the federal waters take over. It's a little bit different for Texas, which basically has a 10-mile buffer where it controls the oil and gas drilling within its area. But in general, it's a 3-mile buffer zone. And when we've talked about East Coast drilling in the past, the federal government has generally looked at leases 50 miles out with the idea that that would be beyond the sight line. It might get beyond some environmental and military concerns that are closer to shore.
Interesting. Curious about whether oil companies are interested in buying up some of these leases.
You know, that is that's a huge question. I think there's a little bit of a difference between buying leases and willingness to drill. So for a lot of reasons, oil companies really want new territory offshore, even though you're seeing a lot of oil development and production onshore. You know, we all hear about the shale drilling boom that has given us, you know, tremendous oil from onshore wells. But what's happening is oil companies do like to have a diverse portfolio. So they like to have offshore assets that actually complement what's happening onshore. Offshore, you know, in these waters in the Gulf of Mexico and other places, they can find discoveries that yield oil and can produce oil for decades, which is in contrast to what they see on land. Companies like that optionality. They like the opportunity to have a diverse portfolio. And frankly, in the Gulf of Mexico, they're going into deeper territory in search of crude and think that they might actually have better luck in some of these areas like the eastern Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic. Again, it's a different thing when you actually talk about drilling. 10 years, 15 years from now, if they buy these leases, they're going to be pressed to drill to look for discoveries. And frankly, you know, the appetite may not be there. It may be too costly. It may be too difficult to get local permits or even local buy-in for that production.
I mean, oil prices are so low today, certainly compared to the way they were a couple of years or even decades ago. Even so, businesses are seeing potential for profit.
Right. Well, I mean, what is interesting about offshore is you know, if you find something and you can bring it into production, you know, that money is going to be coming in for decades. And that is, you know, onshore folks talk about the hamster wheel of drilling. They're constantly drilling to produce oil. If you're an oil company, you really like that big discovery that can pay off for decades. And even in a low price environment like we see today, that could be attractive and pay off.
Interesting. And this is about the tax bill that was passed that really opened up the Arctic refuge for drilling. Was that a surprise that it was in there?
You know, the fight over the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and drilling there has been going on for decades. And what was surprising was that here in the tax bill, you had the tax bill actually being almost more controversial, or at least providing political cover for this ANWR drilling idea that for decades has been successfully beaten back by environmentalists and Democrats on Capitol Hill. So the idea that, I mean, I think folks who have covered this issue are still kind of shaking their heads that it happened because it was so politically undoable for so long. the tax bill, the way it moved through the Capitol Hill, it allowed Anwar Drilling to essentially go through on a simple majority vote, a 50 vote, as opposed to a filibuster-proof 60 votes in the Senate. And that was obviously critical. They wouldn't have been able to get 60 votes for that alone.
And able to, I guess, get the votes for the tax plan as a result of that, at least coming from Alaska.
Right, right.
That is Jennifer Dolohy, and she is energy and environment reporter for Bloomberg News. And she's been covering the news of last week, the Trump administration announcing plans to offer gas and oil drilling leases in the waters off of most of the country's coastal states, most of the East Coast, certainly the Gulf of Mexico, and a lot of the West Coast as well. And we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have, looks like, Roy from Philadelphia joining us. Oh, no, we don't. Sorry, we have a little problem with that particular line there. I'm curious about whether there are concerns certainly coming from tourism industry, which is very powerful. Certainly New Jersey is part of that. The seafood industry, they have to share the waters with a lot of these drilling rigs. What's been the response to the opening up of these coastal leases?
Oh, you know, it is the backlash and the concern among coastal residents, particularly on the East Coast, is tremendous. In fact, it was the opposition of more than 140 municipalities on the East Coast that in part helped convince the Obama administration to do away with its initial plan to open up leasing along the Atlantic, along the East Coast, in the Mid and South Atlantic. It's significant opposition. Of course, in California, you still have, you know, the memories of the 1969 oil spill near Santa Barbara that really gave birth to, you know, the modern day environmental movement. And there's deep opposition out there. You know, there's concerns about the marine life in these waters, but also the tourism and fishing that depends on it. I mean, the tourism industry depends on unspoiled beaches and frankly, a vibrant ecosystem. And so there's concerns commercially as well as environmentally from these coastal residents.
And I'm going to assume that the lobbying has begun.
Yeah,
understatement
even
there.
Really before it's out, right? Yeah, it has never ended, but there's a big effort to make sure that this administration hears the voices of local residents.
I'm curious about the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico happening, of course, under the Obama administration. How much of that has recovered? Are things kind of back to business as usual now?
Well, in terms of drilling, certainly things are pretty well back to business in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, again, there is the industry's business has been somewhat dampened, of course, by the oil price. So you're seeing slightly less investment in new territories. And there's concern about the ability to drill some of these frontier or deep water territories in the Gulf of Mexico, where they've made discoveries but haven't been able to bring them into production. So in general, that element has recovered. Of course, there are ongoing concerns about what that oil spill did to marine life in the Gulf of Mexico. And scientists are still studying that, still documenting concerns and ongoing issues.
I'm curious about the regulations of the Obama administration. Are they being pulled off when it comes to things like drilling and drilling leases?
Yeah, the Interior Department has already begun moving back some regulations, you know, easing some regulations that came after the 2010 oil spill, some of which were directly related to it, many of which were not. There is a concern, of course, by folks who lived through that spill that they are going too far, that they will go too far in terms of easing some of these requirements for, you know, blowout preventers, the emergency devices that safeguard these wells, act as kind of a last resort against uncontrolled surges of oil and gas, or even the way, you know, the mandates on how these wells are drilled. So there's concern about that. Again, it's still in kind of early stages, but there is an ongoing effort led by the Interior Department to remove some of these, as they would call them, regulatory burdens burdens on the oil companies that drill offshore.
Let me read a couple of comments, and I do want to quote from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, a comment from Jim: conservatives are law and order alarmists when it comes to helping poor people, but reckless freedom lovers when it comes to the environment. And he goes on from there. An email from Yanvi: free market fundamentalists often make objections that don't consider the full economic impacts of fossil fuel use. Could your guest discuss economic externalities and how they relate to this topic? Let me quote from Ryan Zinke related to this announcement last week. Under President Trump, we're going to become the strongest energy superpower this world has ever known. We want to grow our nation's offshore energy industry instead of slowly surrendering it to foreign shores. We will produce enough energy to meet our needs at home, and we will export enough energy to lead the world. If these leases result in oil, does it stay in the United States? Is it exported around the world? What would be the future of this oil?
Yeah, I mean, we are, of course, talking hypotheticals way down the line. However, we know that the U.S. is exporting more oil today. And obviously, the crude export ban was lifted a couple years ago, and they've taken advantage of that, oil companies have, to export more oil. Certainly, that could grow. One of the really interesting things about that Zinke comment that you just read is that this administration is really aiming for a different thing. They're aiming for what they would call energy dominance. The Obama administration liked to talk a lot about U.S. energy independence. But for the Trump administration, it's all about dominance. It's about, you know, really dominating the global market in oil. And right now, the U.S. is not as attractive offshore as some other areas for oil companies around the world. Partly that's because the Gulf of Mexico is kind of the one area that we've made available. And so this administration is kind of responding to that concern and the notion that, gosh, oil companies are going to Mexico, Mexican waters, for instance, and drilling there. They're going to Brazil. They're going to other places besides the U.S., and we want to keep that investment here. So the administration's push is in part a desire to keep that investment in the United States.
An email from Anthony: would these leases be available to oil drilling companies from Russia? Do we know the answer to that, Jennifer?
You know, this is a little bit outside my expertise. Obviously, U.S. Sanctions on Russia would be at play and I think be a significant barrier to any investment there, though I am hardly an expert. That said, we do know that other foreign nationals would of course, be interested and are already engaged in offshore drilling in the U.S.
You mentioned the fact that activists really went against the Obama administration when they tried to open up some of these leases. Do you see them gearing up, especially now that these leases cover most of the coastal United States?
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. So the exact same people who, you know, raised their voices, went to city halls, pushed, you know, resolutions against offshore drilling 2 years ago under the Obama administration are poised to do exactly the same thing. They're getting engaged already. They're planning, you know, their attack. And frankly, because that groundwork was done 2 years ago, they have something they can build on. They're not starting from scratch. So that's going to be an interesting. It's going to be interesting to see that pushback on the. But the one challenge here is that the Trump administration, by pushing so much on the table, by making this such a big and bold plan, they've actually, you know, they're making things harder for environmentalists and local activists who want to push back, because they're not going to be able to fight just, you know, Atlantic drilling or just Eastern Gulf and Arctic drilling, which arguably are the areas the oil companies most want to see. They're also going to have to pay attention to the Pacific and some of these other areas. And so, you know, it's an interesting strategic move, I think, by the Trump administration that forces environmental activists to be strategic as well.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jennifer Dolohy is energy and environment reporter for Bloomberg News. We began the conversation talking about, creating an economy that's based on renewables, and ending it by talking about fossil fuels and oil drilling leases. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri, with assistance today from Susan Greenberg. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.